Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us at restaurantguysradio.com, WCTCAM.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey, good morning, Mark. How are you?
Hey, Francis. I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing terrific. We need to make our first announcement that we have pulled off a tremendous feat on New Year's Eve this year, on December 31st, 2009.
I got to tell you, I didn't know where you were going. You were talking about pulling off feet. I was very concerned.
Our new Trotter special at the restaurant is delicious. We're going to have fireworks in downtown New Brunswick, and I know it's kind of last minute, but we came up with this cockamamie idea in September, and we didn't think we'd get it passed. And a lot of the New Brunswick restaurants were involved in a lot of the New Brunswick restaurants have come together in an organization called New Brunswick Rocks. You can find out about it at newbrunswickrocks.com. But New Brunswick City Markets and New Brunswick Rocks and a lot of the downtown businesses contributed some money to our crazy idea, and the city council and the mayor and the fire department and the police department were very helpful in pulling it off. So we're going to have a great celebration. So come to one of the restaurants in downtown New Brunswick on New Year's Eve. Have a great dinner, like so many, you know, great bars and restaurants downtown. The city's going to be alive. And then at Monument Square, right in front of the restaurant, we have the beautiful Heldrich Hotel right across from the restaurant, and we're going to count down the new year from the clock on the front of the State Theater and shoot off fireworks at midnight, and then come on back inside and have a hot toddy.
Sounds like fun.
It is kind of
sounds like fun, although I might have a hot toddy before I go out.
Well, you know what? I want to talk. Well, we're going to have dinner at the restaurant. And I should tell everybody, we're doing a wine dinner at our restaurant that starts at 8:30 that night. We're calling it the Old Acquaintance Wine Dinner. So it's all of our old acquaintances and friends who are longtime visitors.
Make wine and cocktails. And
so George Hendry and Paul Hobbs and Kathy Corison and Katarina Day and Johannes Selbach's wines will all be poured at dinner. So
a cocktail that Dale DeGroff showed us.
Yeah. So hors d'oeuvres are 8:30. Come to dinner at 9, and we should finish up right in time to go out and watch the fireworks and have a big teary hug. And how teary I get will depend on how much of the wine I drink. So, but I want to talk about what brought this about, and a sort of a whole change in the way people are looking at restaurants, especially outside of the major cities. One of the reasons that this came about was that Mark and I were talking in September about what to do for New Year's Eve. And we thought, you know, in years prior, the last 3 years we've done a gala jazz concert, rented out the theater next door to us and produced this really high-end swank jazz concert.
Produced a jazz concert in the theater, and it was great.
And $100 a ticket, mm-hmm. plus dinner. And, you know, it just didn't seem the right – it seemed a little too mm-hmm. much for this year.
And in years past, Francis and I have done black tie events with jazz bands
dinner,
and restaurants.
Dinner, dancing.
And just a bunch of different things for New Year's Eve. But the tenor of this year was not yeah. one of
– black tie.
Swanky
yeah, tenor of the times
black tie it just, jazz concert.
And we think that people want to go out and have a great dinner and a great bottle of wine. But the question is, people also – you know, New Year's Eve has the possibility to be disappointing, to be anticlimactic. So there's sort of an incongruity with, oh, just come out to dinner at Stage Left and have a nice dinner, and it'll be New Year's, and I'll shake your hand heartily on the way out the door, you know, maybe even a backslap. So what we thought of, and the whole town was sort of facing the same sort of, people didn't know quite what they were going to do.
Well, I think lots of towns are facing
right.
that.
But
I mean, I don't think this is a strictly central New Jersey
right.
issue. I think
course.
This is a problem across the country.
But this is what our town was. We talked to the other restaurateurs in our town and said, well, what are you going to do for New Year's? And I was like, I don't know, have a all-you-can-drink-for-$39 festival because I can't think of what else to do. So we came up with the idea to launch fireworks off the roof of the Heldrich Hotel in the beautifully redeveloped downtown New Brunswick, and that's what we're going to do. So if you want to come to the restaurant or any of the other restaurants in town or bars before or after, that's great. If you don't and you want to just come down to central downtown New Brunswick, or even in a lot of the outlying areas, you're going to be able to see these fireworks. It's going to be spectacular, so we hope that we see you then. But the very thing that got us to thinking about, you know, what is the tenor of the times? How do people think? I think that everyone's sort of reexamining their relationship with restaurants. And we're very grateful for the deep roots we have in the community and the people know that, you know, we're a special thing and a part of people's lives.
You know, you guys have heard me say this a lot this year. I'm glad to be an established restaurant right now.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what it's like to be a new restaurant trying to establish new customers with new loyalties. I can't imagine.
So, one of the things that's happened is the way that people write about restaurants has changed. And I remember in the downturn of the late 80s when America's new romance with food and restaurants, what happened was that the restaurants went from all being, you know, rich, you know, sundae tomatoes, foie gras, and balsamic vinegar were the new ingredients and they were expensive ingredients, to being more casual, you know, homey, home cuisine, like was the watchword of the day. And the way people wrote about food was different. And what Mark and I have noticed of late is the way people write about food, there's a lot less emphasis on the elegant.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I think is a mistake is that sometimes in the outer boroughs and outside of major cities like Chicago is still vibrant and New York is still vibrant. So the way they rate the restaurants in New York is with stars, 1 through 4 stars. And in the explanation box of the star ratings in New York, they explain that 2 stars is very good. 3 stars is excellent. 4 stars is extraordinary. And 1 star is good, right? In New Jersey, they don't use stars. They've never used stars. But they use the words. They use good, very good, excellent, and extraordinary.
Or it's very easy to extrapolate from that point.
Sure. And it does make a distinction because maybe the frame of reference is a little different in the city and out of the city. And I think that's fair. They've changed the way that they review restaurants. They've changed the words that they use in New Jersey.
And it's painful.
It's painful.
Okay, as a restaurant owner, it's painful. As a reader, it's painful. As a restaurant owner,
as a resident of the state of New Jersey, it's insulting.
So basically, what's happened is you have New Jersey, Connecticut, Long Island are
in the outer borough sections.
Right, are still written about in this metropolitan section.
Which, if you don't live in New Jersey or Long Island
or Connecticut,
you don't get that section in the paper. It's not in the nationally distributed New York Times or in the Times distributed within the city.
But if you live in those sections, you get this particular section. And they've changed the ratings to no longer be, you know, 4-star, 3-star, 2-star.
To no longer be good, very good, excellent, and extraordinary. They are, you want to give it to us, Mark?
No, you can give it.
They are, the best is don't miss. Okay, so in lieu of extraordinary restaurants, we have don't miss. The second best restaurant available to us in these areas is now, what used to be 3 stars, is now called
worth it.
Worth it.
You know what? For me, the absolute worst one, 2 stars. Now, 2-star restaurant is a pretty darn good restaurant.
Formerly known as very good.
Okay, formerly known as very good is now in a pinch.
Right, in a pinch. Can you imagine?
In a pinch. Like it's an emergent. You have an emergency and you need to go to a restaurant.
I need flan.
You better hustle out to a restaurant. This is the only, you know, this is the only restaurant. It's Tuesday night, and this is the only restaurant that's open. So
a pinch means to the people in the New York Times who want to insult every restaurant in New Jersey is now there are only 2 that aren't go only if you have to. Okay, let's give them the bottom one as well. The bottom one is don't bother. Okay, so there are 4 possible ratings to get in New Jersey. 1 is don't bother, don't go. Okay, fair enough. But the second best restaurant in New Jersey is in a pinch, which means don't go if you don't have to, because that's what in a pinch means. You're in a pinch. You'd rather go somewhere else, but if you have to go.
But you're in a bind.
You're in a bind. You have to go there. And then this, the penultimate, second from the top, is worth it. That's worth it. That's worth it. And so there's only 1 rating you can get, which is don't miss. Only 1 positive rating that's possible in all of New Jersey.
But even don't miss, compare that to the word extraordinary.
Yeah, right. There are no extraordinary restaurants anymore.
Okay, compare the words don't miss to extraordinary. And I am so personally insulted by this whole change. And I can't imagine that restaurant goers in New Jersey aren't insulted by it.
Well, I'll be honest with you. One of the things
and Long Island and Connecticut.
One of the things that's happening is that print media, frankly, is just becoming less relevant. And if the New York Times, the national section of the New York Times matters. I don't read the Jersey Weekly section.
Well, the other thing
Times.
That's happened in the Jersey section, and I presume it's happened in the Connecticut sections and the Long Island and the Westchester sections as well. What's happened is we no longer get a traditional review every week.
Right, every other week now.
We get a traditional review every week, and then we either get a hodgepodge
every other week.
Either a hodgepodge of four or five different places, or talking about some farmer's market, or talking about... So where those other little snippets or small reviews or what have you are talking about farmer's market would have been just in the general section of the food section, now we have that replacing our restaurant review.
Well, and if the New York Times can't afford to send someone out to dinner, which may be the case, okay, as they are becoming less relevant, this section has become really... It used to be, when we started in the business, Valerie Sinclair and Ann Sems were the two reviewers for the New York Times, and you lived or died. They were first.
Every New Jersey restaurateur
read that column every week. And I haven't read it in a year. I mean, it's less relevant because print media overall is less relevant. And, you know, people are getting... And for what restaurant you choose, you know, people have a lot of other digital options that they use to choose restaurants. However, you know, I just can't believe the insult this hurls. This is not just you're being irrelevant, you're being insulting. And it shows that, you know what?
But you're making yourself irrelevant. You're not... I mean, you're doing this to yourself at the same time.
So the New York Times is writing about, all they have to write about are mostly restaurants that you can use in a pinch or don't bother, or the best you were going to get 99 times out of 100 is maybe you can read about a restaurant that's, you know, worth it. Who wants to read that? Who would read that? Why would you read the New York Times? Why would you read the Jersey section or the Outer Borough section of the Times to find out a restaurant that you can use in a pinch? Guess what? I got a phone, and in that phone, I've got Zagat, and I've got City Search, and I've got Yelp, and I've got everything else I can
do. I got 50 friends I can call who can tell me a restaurant in a pinch.
And you know what's funny? Is even... I got a question for you. Now, when we opened, one of the things that put us on the map fairly early is we got a very good within the first year, and we upgraded it to an excellent within, like, the third year of being open, which was really extraordinary at the time for a small restaurant owned by two guys to be able to pull that off that quickly. If I got... And we got that two-star review, and we posted it, and we put it up, and we were very proud.
Very
proud.
We
were too young. If I got a review that said that use me in a pinch, I wouldn't post it. I wouldn't let anybody know about it. I'd burn it, and I'd tell you to go to hell. I would
burn it.
It's a negative review. In a pinch is negative, and worth it is who cares. Okay.
And worth it is who cares. What you've taken your two-star review, and again, two-star restaurants, you think about the two-star restaurants that are out
where
there.
Where you go most of the time. Where I go most of the time.
And there are some really, really nice two-star restaurants.
And you know what else there are? And this is getting me pissed off. There are a lot of people working their asses off, okay, to give people great dining experience who are important parts of this community. And you know what?
And
they're doing a good job.
Very good restaurants.
Right.
And you change your review from very good to in a pinch and make me say,
pinch, go to hell.
Irrelevant.
Is what I say.
I don't say go to hell. I say you're making yourself irrelevant.
Well, and to go
because
back.
Now there's no restaurant in there that you're going to incite me
right,
to go to.
Right. Why do I want to read about restaurants that I can go to in a pinch? Who cares? Who cares about the publication? Who cares about picking up the paper to read about restaurants that may, if you're lucky, be worth it? Why would you read it? Throw it out. Use it to start the fire in the fireplace. Okay? And the fact of the matter is I think it's an unfortunate editorial choice because I think what they mean is and I'm not attacking the restaurant reviewer unless he had something to do with this. I mean, this is probably an editorial decision.
Well, I'm sure
down.
It's not the restaurant reviewer because it's in four different sections.
Right, so he's constrained.
Papers
David Corcoran is constrained.
Sure.
What do we do with David Corcoran now? I mean, he's got to face a tough choice. Does he make everybody worth it at the very least? Because to me, worth it.
Right, every good restaurant, you better say they're worth it.
Worth it is one star.
Okay.
Worth it is formerly one star.
You better say that a good restaurant, that a restaurant that you like to go to is worth it.
It's crazy.
I mean, you have to say that.
It's I think they're trying to strike the tone to be more casual and reflect the times. But here's what the New York Times can do, and they do not do now in the Jersey Weekly section. You would read that newspaper to find interesting stuff, to find either great restaurants or terrible restaurants. But if what you're saying by the very structure of your review is the New Jersey restaurants range from not worth it to kind of worth it, go someplace else for dinner if you really care. There's nothing exciting. There's no restaurant review that it can be exciting that winds up in a worth it.
Right.
Nobody cares. Who cares?
Absolutely.
So you can get a don't miss. So what you're saying is that, you know, and how many four-star restaurants were there in New Jersey according to the Times before this? One, two?
Well, one, really.
One. Nicholas, who's going to be our guest after the show, after the segment. But I just, it's crazy misguided. It does a disservice to the paper, and it insults every restaurant in the state of New Jersey and every hardworking restaurateur who really tries to give, you know, a very good experience. And, you know, we strive to be excellent. We strive to be a don't miss. But, you know, I think it's unfortunate. It's really unfortunate. And I hope they reconsider.
I'm hoping that as they listen to this, they say, wow, that really didn't come off as well as we wanted
and
it
to. And we've heard that a bunch of – we know because of correspondence that a bunch of folks from the Times listen. So if you are listening, you might consider passing this along because I think that it can be salvaged.
Because I don't want to be reading your paper in a pinch.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know, I don't want to be doing
that. And your readers don't either. They want to read about something that's like, oh, look at this, honey, because it's not like it used to be where, you know, you have your list of the four-star restaurants or the three-star restaurants. You need to write news, and news is not, here's a restaurant you can go to in a pinch. I just don't care that much. And New Jersey has lots of great places to go. And, you know, restaurants are facing a tough time. But more and more there are restaurants that really impress me as they remain a part of the community. And the food in Jersey, and this I'm telling you, is better and better and better. And the restaurants in New Jersey, the caliber of restaurants.
There are more and more really good restaurants in New Jersey.
And the Times should recognize that and be celebrating about it and writing it and selling more papers with it. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment with Nicholas Harari, who owns the only four-star restaurant in New Jersey, according to the New York Times. And now that they're not awarding him anymore, he's assured that title in perpetuity unless they change their minds. He's got a new book out, a new cookbook. We're going to be talking to him about his restaurant and his life and his book in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're talking today with our good friend Nicholas Harari. Nicholas owns Restaurant Nicholas, as we talked about before the break, the only four-star New York Times restaurant in New Jersey, and now that they've changed the rating system, he has that for life. He's like president for life of Restaurant Nicholas with four stars, and he has a brand new book out called Nicholas the Cookbook.
Nicholas, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're very enthusiastic with that.
Well, I used to be on the show all the time when you guys couldn't get anyone. Now
I'll have you know.
Now you're big time in me,
and clearly you can tell we couldn't get anybody today. So here you are.
Who canceled?
And I'll have you know that Charlie Trotter was our first guest. He also was when we couldn't get anybody. When we couldn't get you, we had Trotter on the show.
Fair enough.
To get back on our show, I think was the main motivation for this. You wrote a cookbook.
That is true. Yes, that was the motivation.
I got to tell you, Nikki baby, this is a really, really beautiful cookbook. And you know, it's one of those basic interview, you know, pablum questions. But I got to say, you're a busy guy. You're a restaurateur. You're running your restaurant every day. You're trying to raise a family. What made you decide to write a book? And let me put the second part of that question in there. What do you think is different about your book than most of the cookbooks that are out there?
Well, I started thinking about writing a cookbook about 2 years ago. That's how long it took to actually write this book. I had a couple of different offers to write books from different publishers, and I, you know, started getting into it, listening to what they wanted me to do and didn't like anything that they were suggesting or wanting me to do. So I decided that, you know what, I'm going to do it my way. And which is really not that different from anything else I do.
Sounds like the whole rest of your life.
Yep. And we decided to publish it ourselves. And that's how we started doing it. It took 2 years to do it because, one, is I didn't have any experience in writing a book before. Two is that I wanted to have someone from around me write the book. I didn't want to just hire any writer. I wanted someone who would capture my voice in writing because I'm illiterate. I can't write myself. It's not that I'm illiterate, it's just that English is my second language, so I didn't want it to, show on paper that way. And I wanted to find someone that would really be able to tell my story through my voice, and that took a little bit of time. And then, of course, the pictures that go in this book, we hired Steve Legato. Steve Legato, in my opinion, is the world's best food photographer. He's the head food photographer for Art Culinaire. Which kind of speaks for itself. And Steve said, when he heard that I was doing the book, he said, I want to be part of it. He's a friend of mine for a long time. And the pictures in the book. We could have got rid of all the recipes and just sold it as a picture book.
It is a, I mean, if you wanted to make it just a coffee table book, you certainly could do that.
Yeah, which is, you know, physically the size of it. So one of the things was that we thought we should tell our story the way it really happened, the way it really went down. And different publishers that we talked to, they didn't want that. They just wanted a cookbook. Give me 100 recipes. Give me a little blurb. Tell me how you held your mom's apron strings as she cooked for you growing up. You know, the story that we hear all the time. You know, you were in the garden with your grandma and all that. And those are great stories, but they're not true as it relates to me. And my story is a bit more gritty, and I thought that it should be told in that way. Not really for myself, but mainly for my cooks. I have 52 people who work here, 18 of which are cooks, all of them young, and they all think that someday some rich guy or woman is going to come along, hand them a bunch of money, and they're going to own their own restaurant with them, and it's going to be, you know, happily ever after.
And I just want to interject here and say one thing. Ah, the 80s.
I wasn't around then, you know, I'm not quite as old as you guys are, but...
Well, we came in the 90s, we missed it too, but just barely, my God.
and it's really not true that that's going to happen. I guess in your case that's what happened, but you know, not in my case. But I didn't want them to think. I've heard all kinds of things, as outlandish as Harrison Ford owns 50% of our restaurant, and Oprah Winfrey is a big customer, and she's given us all this money, and none of this is true, but people come up with their craziest things, and those are not exaggerations. I've really heard that.
Nicholas, we heard a great one, and we talked about it on the radio once before, but I'll just share it with you quickly. We heard a great one not too long ago that...
A rumor about our place.
A rumor about our place.
Oh, yeah. This is great. Now, for most of the listeners, and of course you, Nicholas, we've been friends for so long, you know the story, is that we own Stage Left, and... We opened Catherine Lombardi in the same building, which shares a wine cellar. They're two very different restaurants with two different kitchens, but we have the same executive chef. We are the owners of both restaurants with our partner, Lou. We own both restaurants, same ownership.
The guy from the 80s with all the money.
Yeah, yeah. He's a great guy. He's our angel. We heard a rumor. A friend of ours was at a cocktail party of some wealthy people who are really in the know about the food, and he said this one woman was going on about... Now, Catherine Lombardi, of course, is Mark's late grandmother, in honor of whom we named our Italian restaurant. And we heard the rumor that it was reported that Catherine Lombardi is very upset with the guys from Stage Left, and she's thinking about breaking off from them.
I have no doubt. This is the kind of stuff that I have out there. And you know what? If the public believes one thing, that's fine. You know, most of the public, when they meet me... when they see me for the first time, they figure I must just have rich parents or whatnot that gave me the money to open Restaurant Nicholas. They didn't see the beginning years of what it looked like and how much struggles Melissa and I and the whole team went through to produce what we have here today. We opened it when I was 26. And so they just think I must have rich parents. I could care less what the public thinks if that's what they want to believe. But I actually cared about what my employees thought. And I thought that they need to see these stories or read these stories and really understand it. And I've heard from a lot of my employees. One is, as they said, it almost was like you were speaking to us in a meeting, the way the story goes, because it was in my voice. And two is we had no idea. Most people think that there's a partner or different things, and I don't want to say dreams, because as I say in the book, as you probably heard me say before, I don't believe in dreams. I think dreams are for high school football players who want to make it pro. I think goals are for businessmen. And my goal was to own my own restaurant, and this is how I went around doing it. And that's what the story goes and kind of, you know, takes you through the journey of what we went through to open this. And plenty of doors were slammed shut in my face, and you just got to figure out, is there another door? Do you have to kick this door down, or is there a back window that I can go through? And in most cases, I went through a back window.
Nicholas, but you're a really, really private person. I mean, we've been friends for you know, 12 years now. And there was stuff that I didn't learn about you until I read this book, until I read you did a New York Times interview a few years back that really, really delved pretty deeply into your personal life. Was that hard for you to kind of let that all out?
It's not, you know, my favorite thing to do. One of the reasons, as I probably told you way back when, you know, privately, the reason why I did that story was because there was a story printed about how my father was in jail, And I have a stepfather who's a great man, who's been hugely supportive of my family, you know, for a long time. And most people figured that that was him who was in jail. And because that's what they printed in the paper, they just said, my father's in jail. And we always just introduce him as my father. We, you know, we don't need to add a step to it.
Right.
And I thought I needed to protect him because he was getting, you know, people were calling him at work going, you know, he's very proud of me. You know, my son owns Restaurant Nicholas. And he's hearing stories of, Ron, what's going on with you in jail? And, you know, I said, you know what, I should set the record straight publicly. So I went about doing that, which, yeah, if it wasn't for him, there's no doubt I certainly wouldn't. I would have told everyone, you know, I'm not interested in what you think. I'm a private person, but that wasn't about me. Then when it came to this story, I said, you know what, it should be told in the way that it really happened. And most people who see me in the dining room or talk to me at the restaurant think that I eat foie gras for breakfast and, you know, it's caviar every other day for me, and that's how I grew up. And I thought, you know what, I don't think this is healthy. I think people should really get to know who I really am, and the people who do know me don't know what motivates me, and maybe it would be nice if they can see what motivates me. And so I, you know, kind of, you know, gave a little history. I mean, the book doesn't go that deep into my childhood, but it does spend a short bit there to kind of show what motivates me and what makes me who I am and what makes me tick. And, you know, I hopefully achieve that in the writing of this.
Well, I think one of the things that you really showed was, you know, you don't have to come from a privileged background to necessarily produce a great restaurant or achieve the things that you want to achieve in life.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was about. And I'll quickly go through this part of the story. When it came to financing the restaurant, my attorney and myself spent, you know, months negotiating the deal to buy the place, which I go in very in-depth in the book on how we do it. And my attorney didn't even know I didn't have any money. It comes down to the closing, you know, a day or two before closing, he's like, okay, now how much money are you actually coming to closing with? And I looked at him, I was like, what? What are you talking about? he said, how much money are you coming to closing with? I said, I don't have any money. What do you mean, how much money am I coming to closing with? He goes, well, partners, nothing, got no investors, no nothing. I said, nothing. I don't have a single thing. What are you? And he's like, you know, How are we going to close this deal? And I said, I think we're going to get it done. And when you read the story, you'll see how I closed the deal. And literally, Melissa and I opened Restaurant Nicholas in the year 2000, and I didn't have a dollar. Not an investor. All I ever was my whole career was either a cook or a sommelier or something, and I made a fair, you know, rate at what I did, but certainly not enough money to open up a restaurant and let alone buy the property and the liquor license in New Jersey.
Well, and one of the things I think people don't realize, when if you want to be great in this business, you need to go out to good places. You need to be spending a lot of money in really high-end restaurants.
Or figuring out a way to get in there without the money to be able to experience the cuisine.
And we really, let's face it, I mean, a waiter, a sommelier, you know, you're not making $500,000 a year to be eating in restaurants like Per Se or whatever restaurants that you really need to go to if you're going to learn about this kind of thing.
Yeah, and you know, there's no doubt that I did a lot of that as a you know, before I opened the restaurant. And when I was in culinary school and I was, you know, 17, 18 years old, and I was eating in the city, and back in those days, Daniel Ballou was at Le Cirque, and, you know, you go there. I couldn't afford to eat in this place, but I would literally go in at 10 o'clock at night by myself and get a table, and they would laugh. You know, I'd walk in, and I would sit there, and luckily in those days, everything was on a price-fixed menu, so I could just order, like, one a la carte entree for, like, $45 or whatever it cost. I would drink water, and I remember the first time I did this, and I got what was on my charge, a B&B charge, and I was like, I didn't drink this. And
oh, that's funny.
It was $12. I remember that.
A B&B, for those in the listener land, is if somebody comes in as a real cheapskate like Nicholas, what they would do, and only in a pretty pretentious restaurant. Normally, you think that bread and butter comes with the meal, but not if you order one meatball.
Yeah. So my $45 bill turned into $67, and then gratuity and all, and you know, that was more than a day's pay for me, but it was worth it. And I, you know, that's just one of many stories that were like that. And, you know, that's one of the things I started doing to realize what I wanted to do for a living. You know, obviously there's a lot of cooks out there, but I wanted to do something a little bit different than just cook. And, you know, that's what we did. And
you know, I want to point out from this book, one of the things that I think is inspiring about it, and I think, you know, this is mostly a cookbook with great recipes that are really elegant and beautiful and eminently doable. I think you've done a great job in coming up with ways to produce this that I'm suspecting might be slightly different than how you do it in the restaurant.
It's not.
Is it exactly the same?
It's exactly the same. How many dishes of mine are on your menu now?
How many dishes of yours? All of them. We've changed over. Stage left is just all Nicholas.
Nicholas 2, we call it.
No, I'm just kidding. But we spent a year testing those recipes so that they can be converted from our recipes into, because we use a lot of, mostly everything's metric here. So we had to convert everything into standard so that, you know, obviously that the home cooks in America could be able to do these dishes. And then we had a year of testing them with home cooks. And actually right now, which is blows me away, that there's someone blogging right now. It was forwarded to me from a customer, someone who's going through the book like Julia.
Actually, it's Rob Timko, and if you go to our website, he's a customer we share, and he's a great guy. Oh, he's great. He loves your restaurant, and he and his wife go to both of our restaurants, and I'm reading his blog, going through your book, cooking it. It's great.
And I have seen it, and he has had great success. And from what I understand, he's not a professional cook.
No, not at all.
He's a home cook. And I was worried the whole time about the suckling pig because it is our signature dish. And so we give the regular recipe. It's 4 pages long. That's the longest and hardest recipe in the book. And then we spend another page and a half saying how you can adjust it and do it at home and with a pork butt or a pork shoulder as opposed to the whole pig. And but I still was worried that someone's not going to be able to do this at home, and I didn't want to put any recipes in that couldn't be made at home. And that's the first one he did, and he had great success with it.
Well, we're going to put, for the listeners, we're going to, of course, we'll link, there are links now to Restaurant Nicholas on our blog, because we've been friends for a long time, but we'll put under this show, we'll put a link to Restaurant Nicholas and the book and how you can get it, and we'll also link you up to Rob Timko's blog.
And I will tell you, Rob's just as maniacal as you, so he'll make it work.
Oh, maniacal, yeah.
Me?
Yes.
Am I maniacal?
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes, you are, my friend. Yes, you are.
Hey, let's take.
I thought eccentric. I don't know what.
Let's take an eccentric little break here. We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Nicholas Harari about his restaurant, restaurant life, and his new book, Nicholas the Cookbook. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're talking with Nicholas Harari about his book named after his restaurant, Nicholas the Cookbook. Now, Nicholas, you can get the cookbook. We'll put a link up to where people want to pick it up. It's $45. You can pick it up at Amazon.com. We'll provide the link. Or you can just stop into Restaurant Nicholas on your way back from dinner at Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi.
Yeah, we'll have a link at RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
You didn't even get my joke. You didn't hear what I said.
I got it.
What did you say?
I said you could stop at Restaurant Nicholas on your way back from dinner at Catherine Lombardi or Stage Left.
I didn't hear that.
I hate
sorry.
When he doesn't laugh at my jokes.
You could also go to RestaurantNicholas.com, and I'll find them. It's $5 cheaper if I sign them. That's a joke. That's not true. But I won't charge extra.
Well, I want to talk about some of the recipes in the book, and again, I think Timko's blog is a great thing to follow. However, your story of how you came to own a restaurant and how you made it happen with, you know, gumption and without, you know, a business school degree, I think it's illustrative And it's important how a young American person in the restaurant industry can open a restaurant and that restaurant be a part of the community and important to a community. And you know, look, I celebrate the restaurant business. I think the restaurant business is one of the last bastions of a lot of things, and one of them is small businesses. I mean, there's no local hardware store anymore. There are very few local hardware stores anymore. You know, the little local grocery store you don't have anymore.
Drugstore.
The little drugstore is gone. And restaurants are something that people make a connection, and they want individuals to own restaurants. And restaurants are an incredibly hard thing to do because, you know, restaurants are both a factory. We produce things and we serve things. We're retail and we're production. So, you know, you go to the local shoe stores, they're not making shoes in the back that they get, that they bring out to you when you want them. You go to the local restaurant, or to a very good restaurant, and they're actually making the food. And one of the things that I think is inspirational about your story, Nicholas, is you were able to open this small standalone business and have a great degree of success. But how you did it, your own individual niche, not going up through a corporate ladder, I think that's inspiring and important in America today, and harder to find.
You know, I've brought it up on a couple of occasions to different politicians, and we obviously on occasion get to rub elbows with people who think they're very important, or actually are, and I brought it up on a couple of occasions to different people. Al Gore was the vice president at the time that we financed this deal, and it was the SBA that was able to make this take place, you know, and they were very proud that what someone thought was a good idea, that, you know, that the government make it accessible for young people or people without means to open businesses, actually worked. I don't know that still can be done in the same way that I did it. I certainly know the credit card thing, that hole's been that loophole's been closed. I think I might have my own name on that loophole. But the importance of seeing what it is, because I'm not opening a restaurant these days, and nor do I no longer need to, you know, find the money in that same way. But there are other ways. I know there is, because there are always ways to figure out how you want to get something accomplished. And if people think that the only way to get it is to save all the money you've ever made and then find people to lend you money, I'm telling you, that's only one of the ways. That's the easiest of the ways. I always kind of went through life thinking there's the right way, the wrong way, and my way. And in the way that we did it, it was certainly my way. The story for that self speaks for itself. The editor of our story actually said it's a great story, but it's not believable. The exaggerations, and if anything, that's toned down, just because it needed to be shortened to a point of, you know, I don't want it to go on for 100 pages. It is absolutely true. We absolutely opened Restaurant Nicholas with $0 in our pocket. I was 26 years old. I come from a poor background with, no money is the understatement. And cooking at my, mother or grandmother's apron strings couldn't have been further from the truth. Literally, there were days that you didn't know where your next meal was going to come from.
You know, it's funny when you talk about how there has to be capital available for young people who want to become entrepreneurs, and there are fewer and fewer businesses where you can become an entrepreneur, because you cannot open a hardware store. You cannot open a drugstore anymore, because Rite Aid will kick your butt and Home Depot will kick your butt, and there's no...
I think the restaurant world, though, is like that, too, unless you're going to do something that's a niche.
Sure. Yes, but at least the
right,
niche...
Try and open a little fast food burger joint next to between McDonald's and Burger King.
But the niches are still available, and I think people are more responsive to, you know, looking for that in individual restaurants. But I'll tell you, a similar thing happened with us. We found a wonderful partner, a guy named Lou Rivero, who remains our partner today. He's our partner in the real estate we own, the building we're in, as well as the restaurants, and he backed us. But we had, among the three of us, $120,000 when we started our restaurant at 26 and 27 years old. And as Nicholas relates in his book, and as we'll relate to you, we did the same thing. It was credit cards. We went out and played the balance transfer game with our credit cards. It's not really, if you go to business school, there's the page that has the description of that has a circle around it and a line through it, you know?
The irony is my wife basically submitted our business plan to one of her business classes when she was in college.
Which she helped her write, so it was legit.
Right, and I think she got a C+. Not believable, can't happen, this business will fail.
That's kind of funny.
Oh, how right they were, my God. But, you know, it's you have to be creative with how you're going to get capital. And, you know, as the credit markets tighten up, like you said, the credit card loophole that you used to get open and that we used to stay open the first year, because, like you said, you and Melissa didn't take a salary in your entire first year. Mark and I made...
First year, $8,000.
$8,000 a year.
I figured it out. We made $8,000 first year, and we spent about $15,000 in restaurants.
Yeah, and you know, if you don't have a source of ready credit available to young entrepreneurs who aren't, you know, part of a larger corporate culture, it's going to impact what's available to people in our culture. And I don't think we want to lose our farms, and I don't think we want to lose our small businessmen. It can't all be just a big corporate haven. It can't be all that. It needs to be a balance.
We have 52 people who work for us. We created those 52 people's jobs. We absolutely created them. There's no question about it. This was a vacant lot with nobody working at it, in essence, when we took it over. And that's what makes the economy go around.
You know, they say that as far as jobs created per dollars spent or per dollars of profit, the restaurant industry is about as good as you can do. Those are statistics that come from the government. I mean, if you have a bank, right, and that bank – you say, okay, Mr. Bank, this bank, we will generate, we'll give you the opportunity to have another $1 million in revenue. The bank doesn't go out and hire another person. Another person works another hour a week to handle that extra $1 million. You give a restaurant an additional $1 million in revenue, they got to hire three waiters and a cook. At least
more than that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so for every dollar spent, which is something we were talking about earlier, if you want to get political for a moment, and
sure.
Talk about, there's a move afoot, and I'm not hopeful because it's so rare that our government does things that make sense. But there's a move afoot to restore business meal deductibility. Right now, you can only deduct a business meal 50%, where you can deduct everything else: airplane travel, flowers, chocolates,
chocolate,
Broadway
whatever.
Theater tickets, a limo,
hotel rooms.
You can deduct that all 100%
as a business expense.
But if you take somebody out to dinner and try and close a deal, a legitimate business deal at Nicholas's restaurant or our restaurant, it's only a 50% deductible. If all we want, we're not looking, the restaurant industry is not looking for anything special. We're looking to at least have the disadvantage that we're already operating under reduced, so that maybe if we're 80% deductible, we will put more money into the restaurant business. For every dollar that goes into the restaurant business, we hire more workers dollar for dollar.
I mean, we're talking about unemployment. You know, right. One of the fastest ways to decrease unemployment would be to add revenue to the restaurant business, because we hire people at a much faster rate per dollar
than the auto business or any other business. Would you agree with that, Nicholas?
I would, which probably is why this business is so difficult, because we have to hire more people per dollar spent.
Right.
You know, if you just make another, you know, $500,000 in revenue and you could only hire one person, you know, we wouldn't be talking right now, because I'd be on a beach somewhere.
I might talk
to you from the beach.
Can I tell you what's really funny?
You know that I wouldn't be
You'd be in your kitchen.
I could win $10 million
right.
tomorrow and I'd be here. That's the truth.
Your kids might be on a beach somewhere, but you would be in your kitchen right where you are right now.
So I want to ask one question of you that, And I know that, you know, you're going to personalize this in some way, but what qualities do you think that somebody needs to have to be a great restaurateur? What do you absolutely have to have in order to succeed in this business?
I think that you have to have incredible intelligence. And I don't mean, like, you know, the guy who's got to walk around saying, or the woman to walk around saying that they're the smartest person around. I think that you have to have street smarts. I don't think you're going to get it done unless you have street smarts. And I grew up on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is what, you know, makes me successful. There are some restaurateurs that are just great people person and just be able to talk to people and make them feel special and all that kind of stuff and be like a great host. That ain't me.
But that's only 10% of it anyway.
That's not me. My customers will tell you straight up, that's not me.
Mm-hmm.
That And I think, obviously, being a great chef and a sommelier and all that kind of stuff goes well in that. But I don't think that that's because, you know, some restaurants have nothing to do with chefs. You take it that burger joint or whatever it is. I think if the person who owns that has more street smarts than everyone around them, they'll make it work. They'll figure it out.
You know, it's funny because I wrote in my notes what I wrote in my notes was problem solving.
Yeah,
you have to have the ability to problem solve.
Right, and that's kind of what I'm. Mm-hmm. Kind of saying, you know, problem solving is, you know, when the four kids are walking up to you and you're going to get your butt kicked.
Uh-huh.
That's a problem that needs to be solved. and that's street smarts. How am I going to get away with this?
Can I tell you one thing that I want to really bring us back to an earlier point on is one thing that really bothers me when people criticize the restaurant industry. And when I say, the only response I ever hear to the idea that, well, you know, spending money in restaurants, you know, we create all these jobs, and people say, oh, you're just burger flippers. You just create burger flipping jobs. And what it really pisses me off, and I'll tell you why. Yeah, well, there are a lot of burger flipping jobs. There are a lot of entry-level jobs. There are a lot of jobs for people who don't have very many skills. But the restaurant industry, especially the independently owned restaurant industry, every restaurateur I know, even the mediocre ones, has a vested interest and works a long time in trying to give the people they have the skills that they need to get better, because it's cheaper for us, and it's also sort of what we want to do, but it's cheaper for us to train the people we have and make them better and better and better. And so the restaurant industry is one of those few industries where you can start as a dishwasher, as a sweeper, as you did, wiping down the tables at the pizzeria, and wind up owning the place. And you know, that is not available in many industries. And so I don't want to hear about, oh, all restaurant jobs are dead-end jobs, he's just a waiter. Screw you. I was a waiter, too, and I was a bartender, and those were good jobs in and of themselves, even if I didn't become the owner.
Right.
The good professional jobs.
The guy working
radio
the
host.
The guy, well, yeah, yeah, there you go.
This, of course, is not a respectable job at all. This should be disparaged.
The guy working on the assembly line in the auto factory is never going to make cars.
Right. He's never going to own the car company, ever. And you know what? What's wrong with being – why would we look down our nose at someone who's a waiter or a bartender or a captain or a sommelier or a line cook or a really good cook?
That's what we do.
Oh, it's
That's
crazy.
What people do. You know, they judge. They judge. But usually the person judging is the one making less money than the captain or the –
Yeah,
know,
that's true.
The, you know, people can make an honest living in this field, and they can enjoy doing it. It could be interesting. We had someone in here the other day. They had bought a case of wine, and I was bringing it into their car for them. And there was a young girl sitting in the front seat, and I said hello to her. And he said, "You don't remember who that is, do you?" And I said, "Well, no, I don't think I've ever met her." And he said, "Well, you actually haven't, to tell you the truth. You did her baby shower."
Oh, that's great.
At the restaurant. And this girl was 8 years old. I mean, I don't know what 8 year olds look like, but she looked older than that. But it was like, I can't believe this. I mean, here's this girl that we did her baby shower 8 years ago, and they're at the restaurant. We had someone in 2 weeks earlier. They had their bar mitzvah here, and the girl is getting married. Bat mitzvah, I guess it's called. And she's getting married. And this is what, you know, you're part of their family. There's no question about it. They're
totally.
Always going to remember where they did that, you know, where the baby shower was. And, you know, that's just two small stories. There's so many stories that go into 9 years of being open and people coming here for Christmas Eve tradition and all that. You're part of the community, whether you like it or not. And that's why we're looked down upon. I don't know. I can't give you an answer.
Well, and let me point out to you that if you ran in that site, you were the, or had been for a while anyway, the general manager of one branch of a chain restaurant, it wouldn't make a goddamn bit of difference whether she'd gotten bar mitzvah there, bat mitzvah there, or christened there, or it's a chain restaurant. Who cares? But when it's an individually owned restaurant run by people, it makes all the difference in the world. Mark and I say it all the time. It's about being a part of people's lives and a part of the community.
Well,
we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back, and Nicholas, I'm going to ask you for some of your favorite recipes from the book, and you're going to let us put one of them up on our website, so you have about 30 seconds to figure out which one. You're
okay.
Listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTCAM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. I would like to announce the most exciting new project Mark and I have launched in years. We've teamed up with some old friends, Mike and Jennifer Schnur, and worked with our chefs and purveyors of artisanal food products to create RestaurantGuysChocolate.com. Yeah, baby, we've created a line of extraordinary and delicious chocolates in a palette of thoughtful and complex flavors. They're sexy, they come in a great, beautiful red box, they're handmade, and they make a perfect gift or a perfect personal indulgence. We ship overnight, or you can pick them up at the restaurants. The website is restaurantguyschocolate.com, or find the link at restaurantguysradio.com. We put our heart and soul into every box, and each one's made by hand. There's a little bit of my soul in every piece of candy, that's right, and a little bit of Mark's too. So check out restaurantguyschocolate.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, talking with Nicholas Harari, our dear friend and companion. We only have a little bit left in the show, a little bit of time left. But I want to recommend the cookbook. It's great. The pictures are wonderful, and I find pictures very helpful in a cookbook like this because you can see what it's supposed to look like. But if you were going to have someone attack this cookbook, what's a recipe that they shouldn't miss if they're only going to cook a couple of recipes out of it?
Well, I wouldn't look at it as what they shouldn't miss. I'm going to pick my favorite recipe because it's the easiest recipe, and it's the most requested thing that we do each year. And so I'd want them to start out with something easy so they can gain some confidence that this book can actually be used and be successful. And it's the minted pea soup. It's on page 61 in the cookbook. And I've caught a little bit of flack because the dish that we present is the way we exactly serve it at the restaurant as a picture because it has the Parmesan flan, but I did not add the Parmesan flan into the recipe because you can make the soup in about 6 minutes.
Really flack you got for that?
I got some people. Your friend there, Robert Timko, has given me a little bit of grief on it.
He's keeping you honest, man. He's just keeping you honest.
Yeah, that's fine because everything in the book is true to the exact way that it's presented. But this one we didn't because I wanted you to make this dish in 6 minutes, where the flan, it's a whole other process. And it's also ingredients that are so readily available. We only do this in the spring. It's only for 3 weeks because we use spring peas for it.
Right.
But when we adjusted the recipe, we used a pound of frozen peas, which are available all year long. And truly, it actually came out better with the frozen peas.
Really?
Frozen peas are an item that freezes really well, and they freeze them at their absolute peak of ripeness. And, we have some issues here on using frozen peas in the restaurant, probably philosophical. But you know what? In your home, one thing is I'd use frozen peas and I'd use a butterball turkey because it actually tastes better.
Minted pea soup. We're going to post that at restaurantguysradio.com. The book is Nicholas, the cookbook, and you can find that at nicholas.com or at our website. You can find it as well.
Hey, Nicholas, thanks for being here. I bet when we offered to interview you, you thought you'd get to talk more.
No, I know who you guys are.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, listen, have a happy holidays, and we'll see you shortly after the new year.
All right, see you soon.
Thanks, Nicholas.
Well, Nicholas, thanks a bunch for being on the show. I hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. You know what? I think Nicholas is almost an honorary restaurant guy. I think you should make him an honorary restaurant guy, Nick.
Yeah. We like your song so much, we're going to make you an honorary Ramon.
But you have enjoyed this hour with the 2.5 Restaurant Guys. I know that we certainly have. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys at WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com.